You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right, so we have gone through 23 years of misery with Jeremiah so far, as he has predicted the coming invasion of the Babylonians and the imminent sacking of the capital city, Jerusalem. And it has been all about lament, about loss. And the questions that emerge out of that, where is God? What is God doing? And it's a moving and, I think, powerful section of this prophetic book that we've been reading. But now we want to move toward the other side of the title of this series, Jeremiah, the Prophet of Lament and Hope. We want to talk more about hope, because hope really dominates the next really half of the letter, or the collection of letters, the book of Jeremiah. And so today we're in chapter 29. We're going to borrow a little bit from chapter 32 on the subject of resident aliens, the issue that arises because of the deportation after Nebuchadnezzar's destruction of the city of Jerusalem beginning in 605. And we pick up the background story here. The siege of Jerusalem is described for us historically, both in the Old Testament, in the book of Jeremiah and others, and also in the historical chronicles of the Babylonians. So we read in 2 Kings chapter 24, verses 10 to 14, at that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, went up to Jerusalem and laid siege to the city. And he carried out all the treasures from the house of the Lord, that's the temple, and the treasures of the king's house. Then he led away into exile 10,000 captives. No one remained except for the poorest people of the land. So that is the Jewish historian witnessing these events as they're unfolding right before him. And then we find that the Babylonians are saying something almost identical, namely that in the seventh year of Nebuchadnezzar, in the month of Chislev, the king of Babylon assembled his army, and after he had invaded the land of Hatti, he laid siege to the city of Judah. On the second day of the month of Adar, he conquered the city and took the king Jehoiakim prisoner. He installed in his place a king named Zedekiah of his own choice, and after he had received rich tribute, he sent forth to Babylon. So they're saying the same thing. This is not some myth that we're unpacking here this morning. We're talking about real events that are happening in real time to real people. We read on that from the Babylonian Chronicles that even the name of the Jewish king is given on the list of provisions that are being made by the Babylonians for those who are being led off into exile. It's really interesting to see just the archaeological insights that are given to us into the truth of the accuracy of the events that are recorded for us in the scripture. But the main focus of the Bible is not merely on the facts as they present themselves, but rather on the deeper underlying thing that really drives history, which is that there is a God in the mix who is working through his people to accomplish a great purpose on the earth. And so we read through the biblical lens that Israel is being led off into captivity because of their unfaithfulness. It's not just that Babylon is a bigger army, more powerful empire. It's because the people have been unfaithful to God and have forfeited his protection. And so we read in Jeremiah 32 that they built high places to Baal, the Canaanite fertility god, that are in the valley of Ben-Hinnom, to cause the sons and daughters to pass through the fire of Molech, which I had not commanded them, nor had it entered my mind that they should do this abomination to cause Judah to sin. Molech is a god of fire, and to worship him, you throw precious things into his outstretched arms, under which is a blazing fire. And at the key moment of the worship of this god is to throw your own children into his blazing arms. And Jeremiah is like, it's just inconceivable that God's people would have descended to this low and debased place to worship that instead of the God who liberated them from the Egyptians and so forth. The injustice of God's people also caused forfeit of their right to the land. Jeremiah tells us that they're fat and sleek. They excel in the deeds of wickedness. Well, they're good at something. They do not plead the cause of the orphan that he may prosper. They do not defend the rights of the poor. Then he concludes, shall I not punish these people, declares the Lord? So it's like there are consequences to injustice. And God is going to allow his people who have acted this way to experience those consequences. Not because they do it here and there, now and then, but that there's a legacy of the abuse of human rights, of the turning to other gods, and which they seem incapable of turning from. And so we read in Jeremiah 18, if that nation I've spoken to turns from its evil, I will relent concerning the calamity I was bringing on it. Oh, turn back, each of you, from his evil way. You can just hear God calling to his people, and all he gets is their back and not their face. And as we were talking about last week from Jeremiah 25, he says, I've spoken to you again and again, but you have not listened. And Yahweh has sent you all his servants, the prophets, again and again, but you've not listened, nor have you inclined your ear to hear. And so it's just like, okay, this is God's world that we live in. And we have the opportunity to experience the abundance and the blessing of God by simply yielding to his design, to his will and purpose for our lives. Or we can choose to go our own way. And we are free to choose our own way. But we're not free with respect to the consequences of going our own way. And this is what Israel is experiencing. But that's not the end of the story, and that's the important part. The story goes on, and in fact, even in this calamitous moment, good news begins to leak through the pages of our prophet as he moves forward. This morning, we want to focus on the fact that there are 70 years that Israel is assigned to captivity to Babylon, and that in those 70 years, God is still going to be at work. We read in chapter 25, verses 8 and 11, therefore, thus says Yahweh, because you have not obeyed my words, this whole land will be a desolation and a horror, and the nations will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. That's based upon Moses in Leviticus in the law, where he says the land will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of the desolation while you're in your enemy's land. All the days of its desolation, it will observe the rest which you did not observe on your Sabbaths while you are living on it. The Sabbath year, every seventh year, the land is to lie fallow so that the soil can regain its ability to continue to produce good product, and that God, through that sabbatical year, can show his care for his people. And yet they abandon that project. They continue to plant their crops and do all the things that they were told not to do on the Sabbath year. And now they're going to be sent away so that the land would have the Sabbath that they denied it. So that's the grim situation. The people go, and they begin to live then in Babylon as resident aliens. And what we want to focus in on here this morning is Jeremiah's letter to these people who've gone into exile. And it's really pretty interesting. Let's just take a look. Starting in verse 4 of chapter 29, it says, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and become fathers to sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands. So what is he saying here? First, he's saying, make sure that you are living among the people. That's the reality of it. I've sent you not to quit living, but to continue living and to live among. And the younger contemporary of Jeremiah, who is Ezekiel, tells us in chapter 3, verse 15 of his prophecy, that the place that the people were sent is a place called Nippur, which archaeologists have uncovered. It's quite a large city, actually, and this is part of the excavation right here. And it was a multinational city. It was all of these nations that were conquered by the Babylonians, like the people of Judah, they were sent into exile. And so they congregated around this city. And so it was a very fertile, multi-ethnic environment where people are constantly rubbing shoulders. And that is part of God's intent, not to cloister his people away, but rather to inject them into the nations, because God is not done with his work through his people to the nations. It's part of the reason why Jeremiah was called by God as a prophet to the nations. His people are being sent to the nations while they're in exile. There's an important implication to that. We'll talk about that a little later. The point that we need to understand here first, though, that is that while they are sent into this moment of captivity, they have not been abandoned by God. That God is still sovereign. He says, I sent you into exile. That's an important piece of this. That things don't happen to God's people without his knowledge and without his involvement. So wherever we end up going, we don't go alone. And I feel like that's important for us to understand. Maybe each of us here this morning as individuals to understand. That wherever we may have been going in our life, and maybe we're really off the rails, and we've got things going on that we're not proud of, that we're beginning to experience the consequences of. Let's understand that we're not abandoned by God. That God pursues us there. That God goes with us into our exile, into those moments where we're living out the consequences of what we've been about. We must not lose hope, because God is always in the mix. God has a purpose for you, no matter who you are or where you're from or what you did last night or what's going to go down with you this week. God has something for you. He's not abandoned you. He says, go and build houses, plant gardens, take wives. In other words, live. Live your life. Live in the present. This is a picture taken in northern Ethiopia just a few years ago. It is a refugee camp, and it is filled with thousands of people who have fled for their lives. And they've camped out along this in this border region, and they've been there for 30 years. And it's a pretty rough place, and it's very desolate. But they've taken the advice of Jeremiah. They have started schools. They have planted churches. They have their own micro-economy going. And they are praying diligently for that moment in which they will be allowed to return to their home, go back to Eritrea with the truth that they have discovered in Jesus Christ, to begin to establish significant works in that place. And I just, when I was there some years ago and interacted, we spent a whole day just talking to these people about their lives, about their children that they were raising, about the attitude and the outlook that they had. I thought, you know, that is such a picture of exactly what Jeremiah is communicating to the people of God in his moment of time as well. Live in the present. Don't abandon hope. Don't abandon normality. Do what we do in life to prepare us for what comes next. And then he says in verse 7, seek the welfare of the city where I've sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for its welfare is your welfare. And so this becomes another very important point. The word welfare here is the Hebrew word shalom. It means peace. And not just peace like peace, man, or peace out, or whatever. It means the structuring of things that are just. That it's peace because God's purposes are being accomplished in human society. That's what shalom means. It's peace because it's fair. It's peace because it's just. It's peace because people are playing the vital roles that God calls each of us to play in our little place on the map and in our moment in time. And so Jeremiah, three times in this verse, is reminding them, shalom, shalom, shalom. And why that matters is because it is an active word. It's an imperative. He's not saying, you know, you should think about and really long for peace. Wouldn't it be really sweet if there were peace? No. He's saying, make peace. Be a peacemaker. Be about shalom. It's up to you. You have been put in a place where you're being called upon not to bounce back and avoid conflict and be in your own world and, hey, I'm not hurting anyone, so everything is okay. I'm pursuing my own personal peace. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is we pursue the welfare, the peace of that place that we are sent. We are actively invested in the work of making peace in that place that God has given to us. And I think that this is something very important for us as the people of God here this morning, to know that we also have a charter to be peacemakers, to not avoid and to run from the problems that we face in our society, but to move toward our neighbor, to move toward the world around us, the culture around us, invested in making peace. And a lot of us, I think, maybe will find ourselves to be a bit put off by a society that maybe in some ways continues to descend into a stiffened opposition to the things of God. It's harder to talk about the things of God today. The Canadian folk singer Bruce Coburn wrote a song years ago called "The Problem with Normal." And the chorus goes, "The problem with normal is it always gets worse." And it does seem to be the case that the further we move away from God, the more complicated our lives become, the more difficult and somewhat intractable the problems that we face are. And it would be very easy today, just as in Jeremiah's time, surrounded in exile and surrounded by spiritual hostility, the deprivations of being in exile, to become cynical, to become angry and self-centered, to think of just myself and getting by. And this is an important reminder that that's never been God's way. That God always calls us to be lights in darkness, to be the city set on a hill, to be about the work of moving toward the problems with the hope that we have in the God who's called us. Very significant. The same is true in Paul's words in the Roman Empire, in their great opposition to the emerging church, in Titus chapter 3, where Paul says, remind these people to be subject to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready, he says, for every good deed. To be ready. To make a difference, malign no one, be peaceable, gentle, showing every consideration to everyone. I think this is a good moment for us as a church to really seize hold of this calling on God's people to be the peacemaker. The reality is, it says, its welfare is your welfare. We're in it together. We are a common country, and we are a common humanity. There is no us versus them when we think about the social realities that we have, that we live in. And so that common humanity is something that God is calling through Jeremiah his people to invest in, to make the peace of the land a part of their peace. And the truth is, the reality is, that when we think in missional terms about society, it really changes things a great deal. Our attitude changes when we realize that we have a mission to society. We may think of mission as something that happens out there, across the ocean, or something like that. And it does. But we are all called to mission. And when we are intentional about it, we experience results that can be measured. A few years back, a sociologist, a political scientist named Robert Woodbury wrote a research paper called The Missionary Roots of Liberal Democracy. And he argues persuasively that all of the things that contribute to a just society, a society where individual rights are recognized, where people are able to move forward, the structures that make that possible, effective medical care, education, communities where people are actually committed to each other, a free press, a broad understanding of why human beings matter, he argues, is the single most important characteristic in the production of stable democratic societies in the world. And I think that's right. Sometimes the whole missionary enterprise gets a bad name, like, you know, we're destroying cultures or whatever. Far from it. Far from it. And as we are committed to the peace, the shalom of the land, people's lives do change. And cultures also begin to change. Some years ago, the noted atheist Matthew Paris wrote an essay for the Sunday London Times in which the title of it is, "As an Atheist, I Truly Believe Africa Needs God." And the subtitle is, "Missionaries, Not Aid Money, Are the Solution to Africa's Biggest Problem, the Crushing Passivity of the People's Mindset." And I've spent an awful lot of time in Africa over the last decade or two. And he's absolutely right. It is the presence of people who are about human dignity. You matter to me because you matter to God. That is the motivation to create those structures in society that uphold the dignity of all people and which change society, change the world. And it is this kind of spirit, this kind of thinking that is so important to our international efforts, our contribution to the world Christian movement. And I think Jeremiah is reminding us that no matter where God's people are, that charter does not change. And that our commitment is the same to the shalom of the land, to the peace of the land, to the people to whom God has called us, to think of our lives as missionaries must. To turn from a kind of resentment and bitterness. You know, you think about these people who've been led off into exile. Are they bitter? You bet they are. What have they lost? Everything. Right? They've got every reason to be resentful. And Jeremiah is warning them, don't go down that path. Resentfulness, anger at the conditions of where you've been sent and what's going on is not God's way. That's not an answer. It's not the answer that God is working for. God's not surprised by the deprivations of the human conditions and its fundamental injustice. What he calls us to is not resentment, but mission. We're missionaries. Every one of us here this morning who knows Jesus Christ is a missionary to his or her family, your community, the people that you work with, the people that you're brushing shoulders with. There are no accidental relationships in God's world. Our paths cross because God has placed us there to be agents of his shalom. Okay? Then he goes on. He says in verse 10, "Thus says the Lord, when 70 years have been completed for Babylon, I'll visit you and fulfill all my good word which I gave to you and bring you back to Jerusalem. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for shalom and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope." And so here again is this pressing to the future, this focus on hope that is so important in Jeremiah's prophecy from this chapter moving forward. We live in hope. What does it mean? It means that there are 70 years of exile, that's right. But that 70 years puts a limit on Babylon's power too. You see that? Yeah, you're going to be in this place longer than you may want. Most of you will die here. But that doesn't mean that the story is over and that God is no longer at work. He is at work, and there is coming a time where you will return to the land. And this also then becomes, I think, very important as a charter for activity for those who've been led away. Knowing that that's right, in this life and in this world, I will not be probably that one who enjoys that future hope of returning to the land, of rebuilding the city and its temple. That's not going to be me. But I live in the hope that that's coming. And so what? And so it means that now I'm focused on my children and my children's children. And there is a whole mind frame that we need to bring to this thing. A lot of us here this morning are grandparents. I'm a grandparent. I love my granddaughter. I think about her all the time. I look at pictures of her most of the days of the week. What an awesome little girl. There's a stewardship that comes with age. I will not experience the fullness of hope that history will bring to her. And her parents, deeply involved in the lives that they have, working hard. There's a role for us to play in the lives of our children's children. To be that kind of safe place, that you know, you can be angry at your parents, but it's pretty hard to get angry at your grandparents, right? So use that opportunity and that thing to really press the case about the hope that we have in Christ and help come alongside our children to be that kind of aid to their children's nurture and their outlook and their understanding about what God is doing in the world. We can play that role, and I see in what he's describing here an opportunity like that. He says, I know the plans that I have for you, plans for shalom and not calamity, to give you a future and a hope. That's right. For your life, for the nation's life, there is a future that God has. Chapters 30 to 33 are called the Book of Consolation. We're going to dive into that next week. It is the high point, not only of the book of Jeremiah, but of the whole Old Testament. So I hope I hadn't undersold it. It's incredible, the hope that he's bringing, that future hope that he's describing in those three chapters is amazing. To wrap your minds around the God of history, who's been at work, who's demonstrated his faithfulness to his word, is now going to announce a word that will resonate through the moments of eternity in a totally transformed body of God followers. The Book of Consolation. And that is what he's saying. Keep your sights, keep your feet grounded in the here and now. Okay? Marry, build your houses, live in the now. And then keep your sights set on the future. On the hope that God has for his people. And invest in that vision. Invest in that way of thinking so that we're helping to build the next generation of God's people who are perhaps freed from some of the encumbrances of your generation and your children's generation so that they can seize hold of the moment that time and God's program gives to them in their moment of time. Do you see what I'm saying? This is really about how we look at life and how we look at our work corporately. We live in the present and we have hope for the future, and that is how God uses his people and how we move forward together to accomplish the purposes for which he's established us. Then we move to what does this actually look like? Okay? So we have this kind of this perspective that Jeremiah is bringing to the people through the letter. Live in the present, hope for the future, live missionally. And you say, okay, well that's, what's that look like? Well, it looks a lot like Jeremiah 32. He says, I bought the field of Anathoth from Hanamel, my uncle's son, his cousin. And I weighed out the silver for him, 17 shekels of silver. He said, I'm going to show you what I'm talking about, what it looks like. So he goes out. This is a picture of Aleppo in Syria. It's this bombed out wasteland that has been a part of a civil war for going into the second decade now. Right? And it's kind of a picture of what Anathoth, that village that Jeremiah was from, no doubt looked like. Just leveled, destroyed by the Babylonians. And in it, Jeremiah says, there's an opportunity. Buy land. Where? In this godforsaken wasteland of destruction. And he does it for a reason. And we want to unpack that a little bit here this morning. He's calling on his brothers and sisters, his fellow Jews, to invest in hope. He's saying it's broken, it's chaotic, it's a wasteland, and what better environment to show the goodness of God? And so he goes out and buys the land, and I'm sure his cousin's like, sure, I'll sell this crap. Some hard currency, be kind of nice about right now. And Jeremiah's like, yeah, just wait. Because what is Jeremiah doing? It is what our brother and one-time elder in this fellowship, Jeff Gordon, used to call a venture of faith. He's investing what he has, believing that God will, through it, accomplish something significant. It is this idea that we take the resources that we have and we place them before the Lord and we say, God, where, how shall we invest? How shall I invest? What do I do with the resources that you've given to me to make a difference? And I want to say something here that I think is very important, historically speaking, in this fellowship, because I've been around for 50 years in this fellowship. And we have seen incredible things emerge through our ministry. Today, there are hundreds of house churches all over the city of Columbus. We have a very robust international mission program in which 40,000 people in Asia and in Africa are coming together weekly for house fellowship, hut fellowship, Bible study. We're seeing groups of at-risk children coming together and forming supportive groups and Bible studies that enable them to cope and to engage in the complicated world that they are in so that they can be victorious and show an alternative, to live as light. We've started multiple schools, including two that are so important to the at-risk communities, mostly at the South Linden area. There are multiple ministries that are going on throughout the city and partnerships with other ministries like Youth for Christ and others that I think show forth the reality of God, that are peacemaking in the sense that we were talking about a little bit earlier. And I want to say about almost all of them this. They began with individual initiative, with somebody who saw a problem as an opportunity and moved towards it and began talking about it and drawing other people into it. And that's how it works. And I think that that is awesome. And what I'm saying to you is, let's be spiritual entrepreneurs. Let's think about the moments that we have and the world that God has placed you in, and to think biblically and critically about what is the opportunity, God, that I have here, I know that you've placed me here for a reason. Open my eyes to see what is it that you have for me. And maybe that's something really small, maybe it's something really big, but as we're all invested in this and we're interacting together with it, what we will find is that this venture of faith, it transforms into something real and powerful and life-changing. And maybe it's just as simple as saying, you know, my kids are getting into those middle school years and the high school years and those kind of troubled water years. You know what I'm talking about? If you don't, you will. Maybe it's time to open my home, to open our home to the friends of my children so that there's a safe place after school for kids to congregate, a place to hang out and to be cared about and to invest in that way. It's not difficult to do. And, you know, over the years with both of our kids as they were going through those middle and high school years, you know, there were scores of kids that would just hang out. And many of them discovered Christ. And several of them are here in this fellowship and often here this morning. Just why? Because there's an opportunity here. What is the purpose of family? I love Edith Schaefer's great book called What is a Family? We totally bore every person whose wedding we're invited to by giving them the book, What is a Family? It's now about a 50-year-old book, and it's written in this chatty, kind of hard-to-read way. But she makes this wonderful point, it's all worth the investment, and which is this. What is the purpose of a family? It is to glorify God. That's the purpose of a family. And how we do that with our children, with our spouse, with our home, with the resources that we have, these are opportunities that God has given us to be shalom makers where we are. Let's be visionaries. Let's take the opportunity that God has given to invest. And invest even in things that seem unlikely. Because you know what? God is in the mix. Here's the deal. He says, after I gave the deed to purchase to Barak, the son of Neriah, I prayed to the Lord. I prayed to the Lord. Oh, Lord God, behold, you made the heavens and earth by your great power and by your outstretched arms. Nothing is too difficult for you. I just love that prayer. What is he saying? Well, he's saying nothing's too difficult for the Lord. And implicitly saying, it's way too difficult for me. Look, if we're only praying for things that we could just as well do on our own, we're kind of wasting our prayer time. The purpose of prayer is to address a God who made heaven and earth, and for whom, whatever venture of faith we have, it's not too difficult for him. If we are trying to manage our life into some way of living that is under our control, that is easily performable, we're not venturing in faith. Faith takes us beyond what's comfortable, beyond what we can actually do, into a place where we must trust that God is at work and that He is the one who is able to change lives, who is able to bring the shalom that we seek. Are you with me? That is so important. Is anything too difficult for the Lord? You look at your life, your situation, and you think, man, this is really hard. And maybe you've painted yourself into a corner. Or maybe you're involved in people's lives that are just so complicated, you wonder, well, how is this ever going to change? And humanly speaking, maybe it won't. But is God in the mix? Is God at work? And He is at work. And is our vision such that we have to call upon God to say, Lord, this can't be done unless you are invested, unless it's your work? He says in verse 18, You show your loving kindness to thousands, but repay the iniquity of fathers and their children, O great and mighty God. Again, he comes back to this theme, the shalom and the hesed of God, the loving kindness of God, the care that we talked about at some length last week, that his loving kindness endures. And so therefore, ours also for to be faithful is a persistent loving kindness that enables us to stay in difficult circumstances, difficult relationships, as an agent of God's loving care for the sake and the need of the other. And so that is what makes what we call, what the Bible calls, koinonia possible. That means community. It means Christian community. It means that what really is going to change the world, yes, our vision matters. Our initiative matters. It's a part of the mix. It's what directs things. But we do it corporately. It's not our thing individually. It's our thing corporately. And this idea of showing loving kindness in a persevering kind of way, if we can do that effectively in our home group community, that is going to give us the resources to then be able to move forward together to really begin to tackle the important things in life that God has called us to in our moment in space and time. Show your loving kindness to thousands, he says. Then he says in verse 21, you brought your people Israel out of the land of Egypt with signs and wonders, with a strong hand and an outstretched arm, and with great power. And you gave them this land which you swore to their forefathers to give them, a land flowing with milk and honey. So a couple things here before we end. You brought your people out of Israel, people Israel out of the land of Egypt. He's talking about redemption, the buying the freedom of God's people to bring them out of their condition of slavery and into the land that God had promised to them. And I think that when we talk about investing in hope, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about investing in redemption, of helping people who are enslaved to become free, of people who are more than aware of the depths of their failures to find forgiveness. That's what redemption means. And what we need to be able to do is to move toward those broken places and broken people, to have enough rapport rooted in our willingness to show loving kindness that we can begin a dialogue that elevates people out of their cynicism and hopelessness to trust that there is a God who can set them free. And I think we live in a culture that, on the one hand, we can say it just seems more and more lost and just more and more spiraling out of God's orbit. And some of us are afraid for that reason. And you have reason to be. But that's not how God sees it. Because the further we move away from God, the more broken we are. And the more the contrast between light and darkness becomes. And there is an opportunity for us, if we're prepared to move toward it, to invest in a venture of faith for the sake of the redemption of lost and broken people, that we will see ourselves in a place of significant fruit over the course of time. Because why? Because there's really no plan B for life besides reconciliation with God. And if we are persistent and we're moving toward it, and we are caring about the condition of people's hearts and their soul, we will over time find response, and we will find that God is at work in ways that we had never envisioned before. We had never believed perhaps possible. And that really kind of brings us to what this whole thing is about. He says in verse 43, fields will be brought in this land of which you say it is a desolation without man or beast given into the Chaldeans. See, there's a future here. Men will buy fields, sign and seal deeds, and call witnesses in the land, in the cities of Judah, in the cities of the hill country, in the lowlands, in the Negev. And I will restore their fortunes, declares the Lord. What he brings this in because he knows there is a future day. He's able to invest in hope because he knows that 70 years will be complete and the people will return. And so therefore, this is a witness of God to God's faithfulness. The 70 years are up. They begin to return. And there is this really sweet land that Jeremiah bought all those years ago, and it's cleaned up and ready to go, and this is what it looks like. And so there is just this clear faithfulness that God has never abandoned this land, and he's never abandoned his people. And that is the big, hairy, audacious goal to which Jeremiah was committed. That is the example that he's making in reality to back the words of hope that he sent in that letter. I think it's really pretty awesome. And it just really leaves us with a couple of thoughts. How does living as a resident alien shape your sense of purpose for being an American? And second, what venture of faith might God be calling you to as a concrete demonstration of hope? And I just think, my friends, that if this is where our thinking lies, if we're invested and we're interacting with the Lord together, corporately, and privately, one-on-one with him, around these things, that God will begin to seep into our thinking, will begin to see things just a little differently. The things that seem so challenging and perhaps off-putting will begin to see in a fresh way as opportunity. And then opportunity kind of gets in a sense of burden or passion that, yes, maybe there's something that can be done here. And yes, God, maybe you've called me to invest in this way and to make a difference and to show your power, your hesed, your redemption in this place and in this moment of time. And it's never too late for us to begin to think in these terms, to think in this way. I'm thinking about this is the first Mother's Day I've had without my mom, who died at 97 just some months ago. And she was not a zealous, eager servant of the Lord until she was 70. And she spent 27 years giving her life away to the neighbors in her condo community, to other generations of Leffels. And she made a difference. And God used her in a significant way to move things forward and to help to shape the landscape of eternity. And when I think about Mother's Day, I think about that. I think it's my mother was a missional person. And that's her legacy. And I think that's what this passage is really about. Well, Lord, just thank you that we can come together here this morning and be confident in your love for us. We thank you for our mothers and all that they have done to shape and mold us. That we would honor them properly here today. And just thanks for this opportunity to come together in Christ's name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.